Welcome to the NHL Wraparound Podcast, featuring Neil Smith, President, General Manager of the 1994 Stanley Cup champion New York Rangers, and longtime ESPN NHL veteran Vic Morin. Together, they share no-nonsense opinions on news and issues around the National Hockey League. Whether you're a casual or diehard fan, each episode of NHL Wraparound will leave you more informed. Now, here's your hosts, Neil and Vic.
Welcome once again, folks, to NHL Wraparound. Vic and Neil with you. And Neil, how many people had Artur Sviolos and Calvin Pickard in their bingo card for great storylines in the Stanley Cup? Just amazing so far.
It sure is. And I'll tell you what, if you could have predicted that those two guys would battle each other in the Stanley Cup playoffs the way they're doing it, I mean, you should go out and buy lottery tickets as soon as you can.
A lot to unpack as the second round goes past its midway point, but we're going to be joined today by former NHL referee and current rules analyst for the NHL on ESPN, Dave Jackson. But first, a word from iGray.
From Howdy Hughes, from Béliveau to Bedard, we're your source for game-worn jerseys. Go to mygray.com, M-E-I-G-R-A-Y.com, to start your collection today. Get real. Get it from mygray.
Well, Vic, what have you got today on the one-timers?
The one thing that I've got today is the more I watch the second round of the playoffs, I see every single team that's left, all eight of them, all very good teams, and they're all getting exposed or have been exposed in one way, shape, or form. You know, you don't have a super team in this tournament. There's no Canadians from the late 70s. There's no Islanders from the early 80s, and there's no Oilers from the mid to late 80s. These are all very good teams, but they all have flaws, whether it's special teams issues, lack of bottom six scoring, suspensions, goaltending issues, or holding leads. Everyone has one of these problems that they have had to deal with. But through adversity, you're seeing a lot of character. You've seen it from Carolina coming back from 3-0 in their series against the Rangers. You've seen the Bruins get themselves off the mat against the Florida Panthers. You see the Oilers really battle it out hard against the Vancouver Canucks. And certainly Dallas blowing that lead in game one of their series, coming back to win three straight. And now Colorado faced with trying to win a series without Valanciunas. So you're really seeing what the essence of the Stanley Cup playoffs are all about. So while all of these clubs have problems, it's going to really be the one that manages their issues the best that's going to be the last one standing in 5 weeks.
And, you know, you got to think, Vic, when you talk about this, how equal the pool of teams that are left, the eight teams, and how equal they are is what you're saying. They're so equal that they all have great points and they all have flaws. And with 32 teams in the National Hockey League these days, that means you've got 25 players in 32 different cities. They're all NHL players. You can't have those super teams that you had back in the 50s, let's say, even in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. Because there's just simply too many teams. And also the way that the salary cap works, the way that free agency works, leads you to only have a real good team if you've got a great team, like the Chicago Blackhawks were a number of years ago, that you can only keep it together for so long that even the Tampa Bay Lightning, that looks like they could go on for a long time, they started losing their bottom six forwards, their bottom three defensemen, because they just simply couldn't pay them because the salary cap said, no, you spent all your money. So I think that this is what leads eventually to this kind of a pool in the playoffs, which is great for the fans because literally everybody has a chance to win. The President's Trophy this year went to the New York Rangers. I don't see the New York Rangers being that much better than the Carolina Hurricanes, for that matter, than the Dallas Stars, for that matter, than Edmonton or Vancouver or Boston or Florida. So it's whoever is better in the playoffs. You can't really have judged it from the regular season. It's just whatever is the best playoff team will probably be the one that we will see still playing in late June.
No question. This one-timer segment has been brought to you by the Ninsel Wealth Partners. Our goal is to be your primary source of financial advice. Our mission is to provide quality strategies customized to your needs. We recognize that you place your trust in our ability to help you achieve your goals. To us, there's no greater honor, and without question, there's no greater responsibility. Welcome back to NHL Wraparound, and it is now my pleasure to welcome in former NHL referee and the rules analyst for the NHL on ESPN, Dave Jackson. Dave, welcome, and I just want to let you know that I changed during our commercial break because I wanted us to be in the same attire that we usually go out to dinner in when you come into Bristol.
Well, I appreciate that, Nick, because I struggle. I have two modes. I have suit and tie, and I have baseball cap and a quarter zip. I don't really have business casual. I probably need to upgrade my wardrobe.
Well, maybe we could have dinner casual next time. So, or something more upscale. So, but welcome, nonetheless, great to have you with us. And first question I wanted to ask you is, as we have seen these series in the second round evolve to their midway point and now, a little bit beyond, your history as an official and just from what you're seeing now, do some of the more problematic incidents, like what we saw in Game 2 in Florida and Boston, and then in Game 3 in the Edmonton-Vancouver series, do you see the problematic incidents more earlier in series than later on?
I think playoff hockey has been playoff hockey for 6-7 decades, honestly. I mean, and Neil can attest, you go back to the glory days of hockey, the 70s, the 80s. I mean, we had controversy. We had animosity. I mean, that's what playoffs, people all talk about that. That's the difference between regular hockey and playoff hockey. You play regular season hockey to get the playoff hockey. And then playoff hockey, you want that. You want the bone crushing hits. You want the scrums. You want people mad at each other. You want that hate. And you want that as a referee, you want a referee game. You want it to be like controlled mayhem. You don't want the vanilla as a referee, it'd be great. You go in and out, no one notices it. It's a great game. You move on to the next series. But really, as a fan of the game, you really want that kind of controlled mayhem and the animosity. I love watching it. I just think it's great for the spectators and great for the game of hockey.
But do you see any more self-discipline by teams and players as series go on because the stakes become elevated and that most of the mayhem usually gets itself out of the way in games really 1-3, maybe 1-4?
I'm not so much sure it's games 1-3, 1-4. I think it's when the game's out of reach, no matter what game it is. I think it's let's set the table for next game. And I think that's what happened in game 2 you alluded to in Florida. Boston wasn't going to win that game. So they can't beat them on the scoreboard. We're going to beat them in the alley at least. And we're going to set up game 3. And, don't be stupid because you don't want suspensions, but we're going to push back here. We're going to push back here so that they don't sleep well the night before the game going into Boston, knowing that there's going to be the same type of physicality picking right back up where it left off.
I think, Dave, I've tried to explain this to people many times as a hockey person, just what you just touched on. And that is that people say, like, I love the playoffs and the playoffs are so different. And I wish the regular season could be like the playoffs. And I said, but it's a totally different format. It's not the same format as the regular season where you play a team. One team is rested. The other team played the night before. You're playing that opponent. Then you're moving on to somebody else. You may not see that opponent again for 4 months. And that's a lot different than seeing that same opponent looking in the eyes of the same guy every other day for 2 weeks. And so therefore, as you just said very aptly, that at the end of a game, The only thing you've got left is to set the table for the next game, because you're going to see those same guys out there 48 hours later that just punched you in the face or that just beat you 6-1. And what choice do you have but to say to them, screw you, this is not going to happen again next time. And, you know, it's a hard thing to explain to the non-hockey people, but I think you hit the nail on the head there in from the referee's perspective is the same as from the players and the managers and the coaches.
I think that is a great point, which I don't think people realize either. As a referee, you have games during the regular season that are tough games. You know, you got number one seed matchups. It's a tough game. But then you might be going home and you might have a week off. Or you might be going to a game the next night that really has – there's no eyes on that game. It's two teams that are, let's say, out of the playoffs by early March. You've got to do your job, but it's not the same kind of stress going into the game. In the playoffs, as a referee, you're working every second night. And every game is hair on fire, same as we see in every game. So you're going back to the hotel, you're having a bite to eat, maybe grab a beer and go to bed, and you're lying in bed going, well, I got through that game, thankfully, but I have to do it all again in two nights. And it's stressful. And there's no nights off. There's no, you know, because referees travel on the road, they go 6-day road trip, they might be off for 5 or 6 days. You don't get that in the playoffs as a referee. It's a grind. You're away from home and you're being tested each and every night.
So Dave, to your point that you're going to have some low stress games during the course of the regular season. I mean, that's just what it is, that, you know, not every team is going to be great. Not every team is going to be good. And so different games are going to offer different things. But when you get into the playoffs and everything is ramped up, it's got a totally different cadence to it. So for an official, are games called differently in the playoffs than they are in the regular season? Because the environment shifts completely.
That's a great question. I think to answer it to start with, do players play different in the playoffs than they do in regular season? And I think what you get, and I've said this a lot, in regular season, you call a lot of lazy penalties and you call a lot of retaliatory penalties. When it gets to playoffs, coaches tell their players, I mean, games are 2-1. I mean, every penalty you take could result in a goal. And that's the goal that could be the deciding factor. In playoffs, you don't get lazy or retaliatory penalties. In playoffs, you get accidental penalties where guys are just trying too hard. They're just so ramped up. They're sticking the stick in there, trying to do their job. Guy goes down. Or you get desperation penalties. So that's the biggest difference there. You get desperation and accidental penalties versus lazy and retaliatory. And I think the biggest thing, and I think a lot of times you'll see, especially early on, you've got younger officials working with more experienced officials. Because you can't have, in the first round, you've got 22 referees. You can't have 22 veterans because there aren't 22 veterans. So, you know, there's a nice mix. And I think the message, I know I always tried to impart to it, if I had a younger partner, you always try and tell them, listen, it's okay if you put your arm up a second or two late, as long as you get the call right. And I think that's what you try, because I remember I did my first playoff game back in, I think, 1999 or 2000. I thought I was ready. And when I stepped on that ice, I realized right away, I'm not sure I'm ready. That's how intense it was. I'd never seen anything like it. And I'd been in the league 7 years at that point. And it was one-man system, but I'd never seen anything like it. So there's a tendency to get over-revved, and you just want to, you know, get a call under your belt, and you got to make sure it's a good one. Because the last thing you want to do is start the game with a marginal call. So take that extra second. Process what you see. And if your arm goes up a second late, that's okay, as long as you get the call right.
Dave, one of the things that my wife always brings up to me, because we're both workout people, is what great condition the linesmen and the referees must be in. And this never gets talked about. I've never heard a conversation about this in public on broadcasts of any type. But you guys, I mean, you've got to be in as good a physical condition, at least cardio-wise, as the players and leg strength, to be able to keep up for 60 minutes with those guys. And you guys don't go to the bench. I mean, I'm not sure everybody out there realizes you don't go to the bench like the players do and grab some water and then come back on the ice, you know, 2 or 3 minutes later. You're out there the entire 60 minutes. So can you talk about that and how the officials keep themselves in such great condition?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, people would always reference, what a great job you got. You got your whole summer off. If people knew how miserable that last half of July and August is, drinking light beer and broiled chicken breasts, just to get in shape for training camp. I mean, guys show up at camp usually a week after Labor Day, and we have a full battery of, you know, you get a physical done, but then you get the physical tests. And it's very similar to a player's combine, from the shuttle run, the bike tests, the push-ups, the ab work, the plank work, body fat calipers, how high you can jump, leg strength. I mean, they really put you to task, and there's certain thresholds you have to meet to be in that kind of condition. And then, you know, once the season starts, you're in the gym every day or every second day, probably game, day off, travel, but you're in the gym and you're staying in shape. It's a little bit different, Neil, than when I started. I started in one referee system. So we had a lot more end-to-end continuous skating. I mean, you'd get a 3 or 4 minute thing without a whistle and you'd skate by the linesman and ask him to find a hole in the ice. just so you had 30 seconds for you to get your breath back. When the advent of the second referee changed that dynamic a bit. And you went from having to be aerobically conditioned to being a much stronger backward skater than you ever had to be in the one-man system. One-man system, you're chasing the play going straight. In the two-man system, all your big calls and all your hard work is when the play's coming towards you. You're skating backwards and you're trying to move around in the corner. So there's a lot of guys that struggled when we first made that transition. They weren't great backward skaters. And now, when you want to be an NHL referee, you've got to be a complete skater, forward, backwards, in the corners. And to your point, being conditioned, the stress, people don't realize, the stress gets your heart rate up. I mean, my heart rate's probably 120 before I step on the ice, just because you put the stress you put on yourself to get it right. So you're absolutely right. You get a break every 6 minutes for a commercial. That's when you decompress a little bit, stare up at the scoreboard, you know, drink some water, but you're in it the whole time. And I think more than physical, it's the mental stress that you really have to be in good shape in order to do a good job.
And a quick follow-up to that, and because it's not relevant anymore, but I'm interested in this because I don't know the answer, is who was the architect of how to officiate a game now that you're moving from a one-man referee that everybody knew how to do that, to go into two referees? Like, who was the one that said, okay, guys, when the puck's in one end, you're going to be here. And when it goes to the other corner, you're going to be here. Like, because it was new to everybody. So, but somebody had to be the pioneer of, here's how we'll do this.
That was the short answer is no one and everyone. When it came in, we first implemented it, it was used strictly in preseason. This was probably would have been like in the late 90s before they even started using them in games. And we just went out there and went back to our grassroots when we did Pee Wee hockey, two-man system, where you had two officials on the ice, you called offside and you called penalties. And we tried to just go from that. And then what would happen, we came in, I think the first year, every team had 10 games where there's two-man system. And then the next year, every team had 40 games where there's two-man system. And I think the third year, it was completely two-man system. And it was an evolution where they solicited feedback from the officials on the ice. Guys, we need your suggestions. We need you to tell us, what do you think your area of responsibility should be when the puck is here? And then you'd go to training camp in September, and we'd spend hours dissecting it and having people give their opinion until, I mean, it took probably 3-4 years until we got it to where everybody knew their responsibilities and who had to cover what. And, you know, let's face it, you get two sets of eyes out there. You don't want two sets of eyes watching the same thing, because that defeats the purpose. You want two sets of eyes covering all 12 players on the ice. and it's almost like a Venn diagram. You do want an overlap when there is a important play that needs to be seen from two angles.
Dave, to that point, as much as you want to think, okay, everything's covered on the ice and it's covered through Toronto, we have seen two goals in the Florida-Boston series where you had multiple layers intersecting where Toronto ultimately got involved and they helped make the decision. The first was Sam Bennett's goal when he pushed Charlie Coyle into Jeremy Swayman and the goal was allowed to stand. And then we had a play again last night with potential goaltender interference, which obviously wasn't called, on Charlie McAvoy's game winner. So can you just explain to our listeners, just, you know, the process when you've got multiple tenuals on goals and a lot of stuff to unpack?
Well, you remember I talked a minute ago about my stress level before I stepped on the ice?
Yep. Well, did I just raise it here?
Those two goals that are really right up to go. If I had a blood pressure monitor on right now, I'd be about 120 again. Like, people think video replay is a fix-all for everything, and it's not. Video replay, we go back, and you'll both remember, we go back to when it was brought in, probably early 2000s. It was simply to tell us, did the puck cross the line or not? That's the only reason we had video replay, is the puck in the net, because there's no worse feeling as a referee than everybody knowing a team earned a goal and you're saying it's not in the net. And then it's evolved since then. Is it ever going to be perfect? It's not. It was brought in. Offside, for example, was brought in for Duchesne. He was 9 feet offside. He scored a goal. We said, well, we've got to fix that. We've got to have a way to remedy that. And look what we have now. We're bringing the game to tolerances where it wasn't meant to be taken. It wasn't meant to be brought in for millimeters offside. So you go to goaltender interference, which is even tougher than an offside call, because at least with offside, if you have the proper camera angle, you can pretty much say it's either yay or nay. Goaltender interference is not a science. It's an art. It's an art form. And it's always going to be someone's judgment. So if you say, okay, we're going to take it off the ice and go to video review, we're just taking it from someone's judgment on the ice to someone's judgment in the situation room. There's no magical fix. We can't just put it into AI and say, give me an answer here. So to break down the first goal that was scored, the goal that was allowed in Boston, I was watching the game live. It was on an alternate broadcast. So I had the night off. It was Mother's Day. I was enjoying myself. And then this goal happens. And as you can imagine, my phone blows up. I get 100 texts. And my gut tells me, okay, that's no goal. Player's pushed, hits his goaltender. I'm not necessarily sure it was worth a cross-checking penalty. It was more of a shove. It was a net front battle. And he goes into the goaltender. He bangs in the puck. Bang, bang, play. Referee on the ice, he's trying to find the puck. I understand him not seeing the shove. And I understand the guy 65 feet away in the neutral zone, as I said earlier, trying to keep track of all 12 players, might not be focused on what he thinks his partner has. He doesn't see it. They give a goal on the ice. In a perfect world, perfect sight lines, I'm saying that goal should be disallowed on the ice. Now we go to video replay. Now, video replay, they don't get that video and say, give us a decision here. You're going to watch it in a vacuum. No, they're being given that as an appeals court saying the call on the ice has been made. The referees on the ice have determined this is a good goal. You guys now need to find enough evidence, irrefutable evidence, to say the referees were wrong. Let's take this goal away. And I don't think they had that evidence, because depending who you talk to, I don't think it's 50-50, but it's maybe 60-40, 70-30. It's not an absolute. Was the shove hard enough? And was Swayman going to get across to make that save? Because in the rule, it doesn't say, is he going to make the save? But it does say, did the shove or did the presence in the crease impact his ability to play his position? And in Toronto, they determined it was a shove, it was a net front battle, and it was a bang-bang play. Did it impact his ability to come across and make that save? And they had to make a judgment. And their judgment was, he wasn't going to make that save. So they didn't have enough evidence to say the referees are wrong. They confirmed the referees call on the ice. So it wasn't like they're saying, you know, there was no goal interference, good goal. If they'd have been able to come out from the situation room, for example, the microphone and make an announcement, they probably would have said, we acknowledge there was goaltender interference, but it didn't have an impact on the ultimate result. Is a better way to say it.
Quickly, the goal Tuesday night with Charlie McAvoy and the tie-up right in front of Sergei Bobrovsky.
Right. So I struggled with that one on the air last night. First, I saw the stick being hit, which I didn't think was a penalty. It was outside the crease. And then Ryan Callahan mentioned, what about the contact with the pad, which I didn't see at first glance. And going to Toronto, for example, that's why they have four or five eyes on that play, so that one person's not focused on one thing. It's by committee. There's all obviously one person makes the final decision, but by committee, so that nothing gets missed. And there was contact on his skate in the pad in the crease. And Ryan and I both agreed that is goaltender interference. Toronto agreed that is goaltender interference. However, the caveat is they felt he had enough time to reset before the puck came at him. And as the puck came at him, the stick got knocked out of his hand, but his own teammate knocked the stick out of his hand. So if you could look past the stick being knocked out, you just focus on the pad. Did he have time to reset? Whether he did or didn't, that doesn't matter. Did he have the time to reset? And they felt he did.
Dave, the rules committee is really just the general manager's meetings. You know, I'll say to people, I was on the rules committee for 11 years, which I was because I was a GM for 11 years and in all the meetings, but there really isn't a per se quote unquote rules committee. But I got to talk to you about something since we're sort of the same vintage here, but there were several rules put in my time that are still in that drive me nuts. Because I don't understand the reason for them. And I've always gone back to, what Lester and Frank Patrick thought up as the rules way back in the day and why they put them in. For example, icing. Why was icing put in? Well, the players weren't like they are today, and they didn't want to have you get the lead, and then you just keep dumping it down the ice the whole game, waste the game away. So they came up with icing. That's an easy one. But I got to go back, and you may not I don't think anybody remembers this except for me, that playing the puck with your hand in the defensive zone, that came about because Wayne Gretzky was playing Chicago. He broke his stick, went down, was smart enough to hand pass to his teammate, get a whistle. He could go get a stick. So Bob Pulford comes to our meetings as the GM of Chicago and says, you know what, we can't allow guys to get whistles when they've broken their stick. So in the defensive zone, you know, we won't blow the whistle if you hand pass it. So it was almost like a takeaway. They weren't giving the players anything. They were taking something away. They were taking away the ability to get them to get a whistle. And it's still in there now that in the defensive zone, you can hand pass the puck, but it's now used as a strategy. You know, I haven't broken my stick. Nothing's happened. Everything's normal, except that I'm going to hand pass the puck and they can't blow the whistle. It drives me nuts because I don't know why we allow hand passing anywhere on the ice. If we're not going to allow it in the neutral zone, we're not going to allow it in the offensive zone. Why are we allowing? I'm not asking you that, by the way, but why would we allow it in the defensive zone? The same as puck over the glass. I was there when we started that because Ron Hextall and others could shoot the puck over the glass and get a whistle. And so we said, okay, if the goaltender shoots a puck over the glass, he gets a penalty. And then they decided it somewhere along the line, well, if anybody shoots it over the glass, they get a penalty in the defensive zone. So it went from just the goaltender to anybody. And now you get an important game, and talking about your stress as the official, you get a overtime, second, third overtime of a playoff game. Some poor guy just tries to dump it out of the zone, and it hits his stick wrong, and it goes over the glass, and everybody's putting their hand up. you know, look, for there was no deflection off the glass. He gets a penalty. He gets a penalty. He didn't do anything wrong. He didn't hurt anybody. He didn't punch anybody. He gets the same penalty as if he punched a guy in the face. He gets 2 minutes for puck over glass. I don't know. I bring those two things up to you because I love the way you do the games on TV. But those two things, along with the trapezoid, but I won't take you through all that. Some of these things we've kept them in the game. And I don't understand why we've kept them in the game, some of the rules, because they're no longer. In fact, the players have turned them into strategies from what we brought the rule in for.
Well, a lot to unpack there. I've got an opinion on all of them. If you guys have time. The hand pass rule, if you guys brought that in your time, then kudos to you, because I love it. I honest to God, I love it. A moving puck is a referee's best friend. When the puck's moving, you got a lot less crap going on. There's no scrums happening. I say let them hand pass it all over the ice. The game is so fast. I mean, who wants whistles? We want continuous flow. So I say, instead of getting rid of it, let's expand it. And that's just my opinion. There'll be a lot less controversy because we're getting whistles now. Did he? And then, you know, they'll say, oh, he didn't get it with his hand. It hit his elbow and you just saw the hand move or whatever. And then you have to determine, well, did he intentionally hit it with his elbow? Nah, other than scoring with your hand, I say let's bat the puck everywhere. I mean, let's keep that puck moving. But to your point, we let them pass it in the defensive zone, but nowhere else. So it's kind of crazy. Well, we let guys kick the puck all over the ice, but you can't score a goal kicking it. Although we've got the rule pretty good now to where 80% of the goals you're allowed. Let's just go all the way. Why do 80%? You can kick the puck in the net. Go for it. We want more goals. There'll be less controversy. Goal's a goal, right? You can still get put it in with your hand, but if it goes off your skate, we allow you to kick the puck. You kick the puck to your teammate, we'll kick it in the net. I think it would make it more consistent, I think would be the thing. And as far as puck over the glass goes, nobody had a problem when it was just the goaltender, right? The goaltender's got a catching mitt and a blocker on it. We expect him to keep that puck in the rink. But when a guy who can score 69 goals can pick the top shelf, we expect him. He didn't know what he was doing. Like, he put the – these guys are so good. They know what they're doing. And I agree with you, Neil. Late in a tie game and a playoff game, he's not trying to do that. And I think for the greater good of the game, you have to endure – those one or two instances to prevent the other 19 times during the game, they're going to take advantage of it. Because I don't know the exact number, but they did track it as they brought this rule in. And you might be able to speak to that, Neil. They didn't just do it willy-nilly. They actually tracked it. How many pucks are in the crowd every game? And I think it was like between 15 and 20 a game when guys were clearing it out. We don't even have one a game now. So it's cleaned the game up. Games are faster and there's less whistles.
And you know, Dave, I love talking about this with you because even me, when I talk about this with people, that nobody can have the intelligent side of things to say, here's the opposite look at it. You know, like you're saying, why not do the hand pass everywhere? Most people would just agree with me and say, yeah, that's stupid. Why do they do the, you know, they should take that out. I love having this conversation because there is another perspective to that. Just like you said, I always feel sorry for the poor guy that puts it over the glass. But you're right. Austin Matthews can pick a corner from the other end of the ice and score a goal. I mean, tell me he didn't put it over the glass on purpose. You're absolutely right. And I really enjoy that part of the conversation. I could talk about that part all night because I love the logic about the way we implement rules in the game. If I don't see logic in something, it drives me nuts, but you've just put some logic into those two situations.
Right. And just a quick, to further that, your entire career, like when you played hockey and when you were GM, we always had the rule that if the ref felt the puck was intentionally over the glass, it would be a penalty. That was always in there. People say, go back to letting it be a ref's judgment. How many times in your life did you see a referee call a penalty for intentionally shooting the puck over the glass? Because I know I never called one. Not once. Because then you have to, you as a referee, you have enough going on. You've got enough saying you tripped that guy, you slashed that guy. don't put it on me to say I can read that guy's mind that he did it intentionally. It's just too hard to do. So if you put it back, they're not going to call it.
What's interesting about that, and then I'm going to let Vic get a word in. What's interesting about what you just said is that I've always felt sorry for the referees getting their discretion taken away from them and the linesmen getting discretion taken away. I've always felt like, you know, these guys are the best in the world. They've got the best discretion in the world. Let's stop taking away all their discretion in the game. So you've just said something that, again, that makes a lot of sense from a referee's perspective, and that is take the onus off of me. Just say, you know, here's what it is, black and white.
Chip.
Dave, a couple of rules before we wrap up. And the first one is the offside. And, you know, you brought that one to the fore earlier in our discussion where, you know, you have plays that are being, you know, really millimeters that we're talking between offside and not offside. Would you be in favor of a rule that says, you know, once a play comes into the zone that, once its continuum is interrupted, meaning change of possession or deflected puck or whatever, that a play can no longer be challenged by the defensive team?
I think there's a lot of things that can be done. And that I think the first thing would be if you deem the other team to gain possession and control, much like if you had a delayed penalty on them, would the whistle have gone? Use that as the barometer for possession and control. If the other team gains possession and control at any point, then there's no further review allowed. You had your chance to get the puck out. You didn't do it. So no review. I think the other thing would be, and people say, well, we don't want more lines in the ice. But I've always suggested we put a line 12 to 18 inches inside the blue line, a thin line, like the goal line. And if the puck or player who was offside hasn't made it to that second line, no review is allowed. And then people come back with me, well, you're still going to have the same tolerances at that second line. Yes, we will. But linesmen don't miss too many 12 or 18 inch offsides. So the frequency would be reduced by 90%. We'd still have the same tolerances of millimeters at the second line, but it would be so infrequent because linesmen are so good, they don't miss 1 foot offsides very often.
Got it. Well, and I certainly don't think that the league really, you know, needs any more things to go to replay on. And certainly this is probably the one rule that takes up more time than any other. Maybe you got your goalie interference and whatnot, but boy, these multiple looks down the line and, you know, just to find something that's this much off, you know, probably is not what the NHL really enjoys seeing. But the other rule I wanted to talk to you about, which is something you and I have discussed over time, and that's the plays where you see an open ice hit, a clean open ice hit as deemed by the officials on the ice. And right away, there's the pack mentality that some player from the team whose player has been hit feels they have to engage and fight with the player that delivered the hit. And it's my contention that if the hit is ruled clean, why should the player that delivers that hit ever get a penalty? And I think that if you have either a minor or a major only to the player that instigates, whether it's a fight or a rough or whatever, he's the only one that gets the penalty. And the player that delivered the hit, they are off scot-free because they made a hit in accordance to the rules. Your thoughts?
Well, I think we don't have it quite there. But in a perfect world, and the referees have been instructed and they've been much more consistent in the last two seasons, I would say, that the threshold to call an instigator penalty is greatly reduced on those. If there is a big hit and that player is forced to fight, he should be getting the extra 2 minutes for instigating. Because there needs to be, you shouldn't have to fight after making a big hit.
Why should that player be penalized at all then?
You have the option to turtle. You can turtle and the other guy can get 2 for instigating and he can get 5 for fighting or he can get a game misconduct for being the aggressor. You have that option. No one ever has to fight. Now, I know in the code of hockey, it doesn't really look good if you don't accept an invitation. I understand that, but there's no rule that says you have to accept an invitation. So you always have the option to decline fighting. So you need to, if you choose to fight back, you need to be penalized. But I love seeing the two-letter instigator call for anybody that comes and engages that guy. And that to me should be called every time because you shouldn't have to fight a big hit. But funny little thing here, and I was at the games going back about 2 years in Colorado when Landeskog was still playing. He was captain of the Avalanche, and somebody on Dallas, I believe it was, or it might have been the Raiders, made a big hit on McKinnon. Really big hit, knocked McKinnon down. Referees put their arm in the air. They called a 5-minute major, and Landeskog jumped the player. I think it was Taylor Hall who made the hit. He jumped Taylor Hall, and he just wailed on him. And turns out it wasn't a major penalty. McKinnon hit himself in the face with a stick. They reviewed it. They rescinded it. Landeskog went after Taylor Hall all game. All game. Every time he had the puck, Landeskog's on. I was won the game, and they interview. They do the player interviews on the ice, you know, in-house. And I had to laugh because the announcer said, after that original hit, did you see the replay and realize that there was nothing wrong with that hit? It was a legal hit. And Landeskog's response was, yeah, I saw it and I acknowledge it was a legal hit. But I want them to know if they're going to even attempt to make a hit on McKinnon, they're going to pay the price all night long. I thought it was kind of funny. It was like, you know what? I don't care about getting a penalty. You're not going to take liberties with our stars. And I give him credit for that.
Dave, we have hit on so much in such a short time today. And just want to, on behalf of Neil, just thank you for joining us today. And look forward to seeing you back in Connecticut sometime during the preseason next year. And we'll have dinner again. And thanks so much again for joining us. And good luck throughout the rest of the playoffs.
Well, it's great catching up with you guys. Neil, great to see you again. Vic, it's always great to, you know, catch up. So good luck, guys, and I love your podcast. Good luck with it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for being here, Dave, and you're doing a great job on TV.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And now, let's throw to Mike Ray.
Time now for a quick shout out to our sponsor. NHL Wraparound is brought to you by Mike Ray, your source for game-worn jerseys. Head to MyGray.com to get your collection started today. Get real, get it from MyGray. NHL Wraparound subscribers can take 10% off any hockey jersey when they order at MyGray.com and use the coupon code WRAP10. Don't forget that coupon code WRAP10.
And welcome back to NHL Wraparound. Neil and I are in the process of recording our 5-episode series, 1990 Forever, the 30th year commemoration of the Rangers Stanley Cup Championship. And we want the fans to get involved also. So log into NHLWraparound@gmail.com. And if you can, record a 30-second video on what that 1994 championship meant to you and how it potentially changed your life. Another drought that is going on currently is the Toronto Maple Leafs. So the Rangers broke their 54-year drought in 1994. It was the longest in league history at the time. And now the Maple Leafs will be going towards their 58th year, 57 seasons in total, when we get to the playoffs next spring. And Brendan Shanahan and Brad Treveling certainly have their hands really tied to a certain degree, Neil, because Kyle Dubas did leave them with a bit of a mess. And I want your perspective on what do you do first here? Now, they have already interviewed Craig Berube and Todd McClellan for the head coaching job, but there's a mess with their salary cap. I mean, they have 53.2% of their cap for next year going towards Austin Matthews, John Tavares, Mitch Marner, and William Nylander. And Tavares and Marner's contracts expire after next season. The other two, Marner and Nylander, have extensions kicking in. What do you address first with this team? Is it the coach or is it the players?
Oh, I think it's definitely the coach, because you need to know what your coach thinks of the players that he's going to be coaching. But I got to say, Vic, before we go on to the players, I find it just so absurd that you, and I like all these guys whose names I'm going to mention as people, and I respect the jobs they do as coaches and have done. But it seems to me in this 32-team league that you're firing a guy like Sheldon Keefe, who's as good or better than the guys that you're interviewing. So you're interviewing Craig Berube, Todd McClellan, good men, good coaches. But Sheldon Keefe's just as good a coach as them, and you just fired him so that you can replace him with another guy. And it reminds me of what I said about Gerard Gallant getting fired and replaced by Peter Laviolette. Both really good coaches. You know, sometimes the manager or the president will see something going wrong between that particular coach and that group of players. And of course, the coach always loses because the players have long-term contracts and no move clauses and no trade clauses and that. But, you know, as you look around the league and you look at the coaching vacancies, and then you look at who's being interviewed for them, it's like, well, what did you fire the guy you had? I mean, and you ate salary. So you fire Sheldon Keefe. I don't know how long he has left, a year or two. You're going to pay him those millions of dollars to not coach your team. And then you're going to turn around and hire a coach that's hasn't proven to be any better anywhere than what Sheldon Keefe did, getting multiple 100-point seasons. So I just got to comment that I find that so ridiculous. In any other business, in the business you were in at ESPN, would they ever fire a guy, pay him off just to bring in a very similar guy to do the same job? I mean, it's just such bad business practice.
But now that we're here, you know, you're going to hire a coach, and yes, you're going to want to know if you've got either Tavares or Marner or both or neither for next year. But from Trevelyan's perspective, there's also more headaches on the horizon. Brody, Edmondson, Giordano, and Lyubushkin are all unrestricted free agents. Liljegren is a restricted free agent, and Wall is the only goalie that is signed for 24-25. So even if you hire a coach, you've got so many other holes to fill here. Where do you start?
I absolutely agree. Well, you start at the top and you start with Tavares and Marner. I think it's a foregone conclusion that Marner's going to get traded. I think that that's something that you don't need tea leaves to read that. I think that's been all over the place. With Tavares, with John, he's such a good guy, such a good captain. Who knows what's going to end up happening there. But it is a mess for Trevelyan. There's no doubt that this is a lot of work. He's going to have a lot of work to go through. And when he gets everybody signed and he gets everybody in place, maybe he can trade Marner for a real number one goalie. I don't know. I don't know who's, I'm not suggesting there's anybody out there that he would do that for. But it's going to be ton of work, a ton of work this summer for Brad Trevelyan.
I think part of the problem for the Maple Leaf organization is they had a pretty good option 10, 20 years ago from the guy that ended the Rangers drought, being you. And it's somewhat mind-boggling that the Canadian counterpart to New York, the Toronto market, would have looked towards you to say, hey, he got this done in New York in that pressure cooker. He certainly could do it here. And I know that you were a candidate on an occasion to get that GM job and didn't get it. And boy, I have to believe the Maple Leafs' fortunes would have drastically changed had you gotten that position.
Well, who knows? The only thing I can say to that is my mom was still alive. It was 2005. I was being interviewed actually during the blackout, the North American blackout that happened way back then. And it would have been great for my mom, that, you know, Toronto boy, handled big media, handled big city, handled, you know, got a team back to winning after they hadn't won for so long. And my biggest regret on that is that I would have loved to have done that for my mom and had my mom see her son be the GM of her hometown team, but it wasn't to be. And, you know, but they've had some great seasons. It's so darn frustrating that everything is judged only on one thing. And that is, did you win in the playoffs? Did you win the cup? You know, they are certainly a great organization right now, way better than they were back when I was interviewing. They're really respected. They make money hand over fist. But they're still chasing that elusive 1967 cup that George Armstrong skated around the ice with.
Well, I'm not just saying it because I'm your friend and your colleague on the show, but I have to think fortunes would have been a lot different had you been at the helm at some point along the way. This is the Human Side of the Story, brought to you by UBS Financial Services Incorporated. And we're going to take the fan side of things for Human Side today. And there's a saying that if you don't like the weather where you are, wait 15 minutes and it will change. And I certainly believe that that takes the array of emotion for fans into account during the second round of these Stanley Cup playoffs. New York Ranger fans feeling pretty good at 3-0 over Carolina. Now it's 3-2. Not feeling too good. Now Carolina fans feeling confident. The Boston Bruins coming off a Game 7 win against Toronto in the opening round. They go in, win Game 1 in Florida. They're feeling good. But then Florida wins 3 in a row, kind of shifts the tide, and Brad Marchand's not in the lineup, so you figure they're going to finish their series in 5. Not so fast. Bruins force a Game 6. Dallas, Colorado. Dallas blows a 3-0 lead in Game 1. Colorado comes back. They're feeling good. But here come the Stars. Now they win 3 straight and they push the Avalanche to the brink, who now have to survive the rest of the playoffs for however long that lasts without Val Nichushkin, who is now in stage 3 of the Players Assistant Program. Edmonton, Vancouver. Edmonton blows a 4-1 lead in Game 1, loses. Then Vancouver comes back. They're looking pretty good also. But last night, Vancouver able to even the series despite blowing a 2-0 lead in Game 4. The bottom line here is that the emotions, they shift off and on during the course from game to game. And you got to remember, this is really part of the journey. And probably the team that face the least amount of adversity in the times that I've been watching is the 2012 Kings that came in as an 8 seed, but managed to go 3-0 in all 4 series that they played in and route to their first Stanley Cup. So as an NHL fan, you know what you signed up for. The stress that comes from watching your team in the playoffs, that is all part of the journey. And if you can survive this, yeah, you're a warrior. But just remember one thing, when it comes to the Stanley Cup playoffs, count on nothing.
You can't. You got that so right, Vic. And the thing that I went to the Garden the other night to see the Carolina Hurricanes beat the New York Rangers 4-1. And those diehard fans, I got to tell you, I've never been a fan because I'm so much into the business that I see it from that perspective. But they are that old expression, living and dying with their team. They literally are. I mean, they're miserable. They're depressed. They're unhappy. They're pissed off when their team loses. And, you know, now it's, you know, the worst of all is going to happen now. Oh my God, we're going to lose the series. They're still up 3-2. They still got 2 more shots at that 4th win, but the fans are thinking they're going to lose the series. Now, conversely, when they came out of the Washington series 4-0, then they won 3 straight 1-goal games, 2 in overtime against Carolina. everybody was asking me, do you think they're going to make it eight straight and set the record? You know, do you think they'll win again tonight? And I was like, I don't know. How would I know? I don't know if they're going to win or not. I know Carolina's playing better than what the 3-0 record is, but I don't know who's going to win tonight. But that's where the fans are at. They're going to march 16 straight through to the Stanley Cup when they were at 7 games. Now they lost the last 2. Well, they see their team being eliminated and going and playing golf within the next week. So
Chicken Little,
it's what you're saying: highs and lows, and just
sky's falling.
Oh, the sky is falling, or the sky is made of gold. So you couldn't be more bang on that. But you know what? I want to close out by saying thanks to MyGray, UBS, Ninsel Financial Partners. Especially thanks to the listeners. Send your questions or comments to nhlwraparound@gmail.com. And don't forget to send us a video. You can do it on your phone. 15 to 40 seconds of what 1994 means to you today and what it meant to you when it happened, or anything in between. If you give us the right amount of time on that, again, 30 to 45 seconds, you may end up in the fifth episode of 1994 ever show. So don't forget, our website is up and running at nhlwraparound.com. Go on, take a look, tell us what you think. That's it. Next week, we'll be back again. And boy, oh boy, we'll be even deeper into this. Will the Rangers still be alive? Will the Bruins still be alive? Will the Panthers be running around? Who knows? I certainly don't know, that's for sure. So goodbye for now.
See you then.
Thanks for joining us on the NHL Wraparound Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date on all the NHL action.